חמץ לביתי. ערכתי שולחני לחוסון, אסחתי עיני. מלא דוד קין, דוד ימית מאורותיו. זולתך ישחיר השחר, אור יעירני. ואת עטפת הרדמה נפשי, חגור הצק. אף כי ליבי יריס יותר נורא מגיוני.
That was Jewish music, authentic Jewish music. That was Nigun Yerushalmi, an Israeli folk group, performing the medieval piyut, a liturgical poem, Ma La'ahuvi. If you've never heard Jewish music like that before, if your idea of Jewish music is German drinking songs like Ein Keloheinu, Ein Keloheinu, Ein Kadoneinu, or Fiddler on the Roof, then perhaps it is time for all of us to confess the sin of Ashkenormativity, the widespread Jewish sin of imagining that our Central and Eastern European Jewish experience is the heart of Judaism, that the Yiddish language, chicken soup, gefilte fish, guilt, neurosis, and stories of the shtetl are essential to Jewish life. From the Religion News Service, this is Martini Judaism for those who want to be shaken and stirred. And I am your host, Rabbi Jeff Salkin, Temple Israel in West Palm Beach, Florida's rabbi. We are recording this on Tuesday, December 6th, 2022. Yes, we are from Berlin and Ukraine, but we are also from Yemen and Iraq and Iran and Morocco and Libya and Egypt. We call them that piece of us, the Sephardim. But more accurately, they are the Mizrachim, the so-called Eastern Jews who come from Arab lands, who today constitute more than 50% of Israeli Jews. They have their own stories of grandeur and persecution and pogroms and exile, stories that we almost never hear and that we almost never honor, probably because we keep on referring to them as they, as opposed to we. But that's where we're from. We're not from Krakow or Berlin. We're from Ur in ancient Babylonia. The stories of Genesis make that clear. We are constantly going back to the old country. It is where ancient Judaism was shaped during the Babylonian exile. The definitive Talmud comes from Babylon, not from the land of Israel. Maimonides himself was a Mizrahi Jew from North Africa and Spain and Egypt. In his new book, The Wrong Kind of Jew, the author Henmazig writes about his quadruple layers of otherness. He is a Jew in the world. He is a Zionist in the world. He is a Moroccan Iraqi Jew in an Ashkenazic Jewish world, and he is a gay man in a straight world. We'll be right back with Hein Mazig. Hey, and welcome to Martini Judaism. I have to go total fanboy on you, and I have to tell you that I've been following you for years on Twitter. Hey, can we talk about Twitter for a moment? Like, what is up with Twitter? What is the, this is off topic, but maybe it's very much on topic. What is the current Torah of Twitter? Where are we as Jews on Twitter?
Wow. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I think that it's interesting. No one knows where Twitter is going. A lot of accounts are saying goodbye, but a lot of accounts are staying in and conversation is going. We don't know where Elon Musk is taking the company, but I feel like it's not going to go away that quickly. I think there's a lot of people that are invested in it. People are following others and some people have a lot of following, so it would be difficult for big accounts to just leave like that. Some of the people that said they're leaving came back, so I think it's going to stay there. And I think that for us as Jewish people, we have to be more loud on social media, not only on Twitter. And I think that's something we have failed to do. The anti-Semitism is louder than us. And of course, the numbers are against us. But we have to, I see so many Jews that I know that are Jewish that are not speaking about their Jewish identity or hiding it. And that's really a shame. So I think it's a time for us to be more proud of our identity.
Absolutely right. So let's talk about identity pride. I loved your book.
Thank you.
I loved The Wrong Kind of Jew. I devoured it in one night. It was, for me, a literary and ideological platter of hummus. I just couldn't stop. So what made you write the book?
Thank you, first of all. I really appreciate that. I wrote the book because of everything you said in the introduction to this show, that I feel like we have, as Jewish community, have ignored a big part of our community. And there is a case to be made on how there are minority groups within the Jewish community that haven't received attention. We should give them attention. But I think that the issue with the Mizrahi Jewish community has just been that we have been invisible for so long. And we're not just a fraction of the community. We are a large part of the community. At a time, as you said, we were all Mizrahim. We all came from the Middle East. We all came from Israel. And we have forgotten those roots of our identity. And in a way, we also adopted some foreign characteristics of what identity is and what, you know, there's nowhere in Judaism that says that a pale skin is preferred to a darker one, or that some sort of a culture is preferred to another one. It's those are ideas that we adopted from other countries and other lands that are foreign to us. And I think that's why we have to come back to the source of who we are and our identity. And that's what I was trying to do with this book, to share my story, to talk about intersection of identities, different identities within a Jewish person that the world, you know, I don't fit the characteristic of what a Jew should be like, not a good Jew or a bad Jew, or a Jew in general. People want me to be a certain thing. If I'm Mizrahi, I should be anti-Israel. If I'm LGBTQ, I need to be, you know, also rejecting my Jewish identity. Can't be both ethnically Jewish and really celebrate my identity and my Jewish heritage while not keeping Shabbat or not seeing the religious part as an important as other parts of my identity. So I was just talking about the struggle of having all those identities. And I feel like a lot of people that are Jewish are facing the same struggles in different ways.
I really want to get back to the whole issue of Mizrahi religious identity, because I am fascinated by this. And I actually think that, believe it or not, it might actually carry within it the solution to many of our contemporary Jewish identity issues. So let me jump ahead to next week's Torah portion about Joseph and his legendary multicolored coat. You wear a multicolored coat of Jewish otherness, and you use the word intersectionality. We use that term a lot. Can you help us understand, how do all of your various identities intersect with each other?
Yeah, it's a good question. I had someone asking me in one of my talks recently, I think it was in UCLA or Berkeley a few weeks ago, saying, well, are you half Jewish and half Arab? Are you half Jewish, half Mizrahi? What are you exactly? And I said, I'm not an Arab, but I'm 100% what I am. So I'm 100% Jewish, I'm 100% Mizrahi, I'm 100% Iraqi and 100% Tunisian and 100% a queer person. And I'm just fully who I am. And I think that it's very important that we don't tell people that they have to, or young Jews, I see that a lot, telling them, well, just tell us what you are, or choose part of your identity that you want to affiliate with. And I believe that you can always add layers to your identity. Your identity can be as rich as the layers that you can add to it. And every part of you is fully who you are. And that's what I felt my whole life. I felt like I love being Jewish. That's like the one thing that I am the most. And I don't think anyone in my life knows me outside of it. And I love the Jewish people. And I love the Mizrahi community. And I love the LGBTQ community. And I love being part of this world and part of the human race. And I think there's so much good in the human race. There's a lot of bad that we need to work on solving. But I think there's good in everyone. And I think that the, you know, really loving who I am brought me to where I am. And I'm writing in the book how I struggled with being a gay person. And it took me so much time to come out of the closet. And after I came out of the closet, it really gave me tools to come out as Mizrahi and be more proud of my identity. I was hiding my identity most of my life, both the gay one and the Mizrahi one, both being Middle Eastern and gay. And then when I moved to the States, I felt like I have to hide the fact that I'm Israeli. Maybe the Jewish part I could speak about, but being Israeli was another part that I had to hide, and I had to come to terms with that and being a Zionist. So it wasn't easy, but I feel like today I'm probably living my, not only living my full self, but I'm also, it's the easiest it's been for me to live my life, because I don't need to hide any part of who I am. I can just be who I am. And I'm happy that I lost a lot of people that don't like who I am, but because I gained so many other people that love who I am and can appreciate that. And those are the people that I want to have around me.
We Jews are as susceptible to binary thinking as anyone else, maybe even more so. And so the way we tell our story is that if you're not Ashkenazic, then you must be Sephardic. And we tend to lump all non-Ashkenazic Jews as Sephardim, which is really messy. So I've probably been as guilty of this as anyone else. What's the difference between Sephardic Jews and Mizrahi Jews? What's the Venn diagram there?
Right. So it's important to start with saying that all Jews come from Judea, from Israel. That's where we started. That's where our indigenous connection is to. As long as we maintain this connection, it's important to remember that all Jews started from there. But being the people that had probably one of the longest diasporas of every people, any people in the world, we've been scattered around the world, and we adopted new practices and new way of living. Didn't change our origin story, and we all share the same same core of identity and Jewish identity. But we have been, you know, in Europe, and we've been in the Amazons, and we've been all over the world. The two largest sects of Judaism that we recognize today are Ashkenazim and Sephardim. And Ashkenazi means a person that in the recent few hundred years, this community lived in Europe. They adopted several characteristics and language that is unique, like in the sense Yiddish, and culture and food, and everything was very unique to this specific community that of where they lived. Today, I think that the reason that you mistaken it, and so many people mistaken those two identities as the only one, is because Ashkenazi also refers to today to a religious practices. So how do you practice? How do you sing the prayers? What specific costumes you have in your identity, and what, you know, if you're eating rice in Passover or not. And the other group of that people recognize in the Jewish community most permanently is the Sephardi Jews. Sephard in Hebrew means Spain. And this is the community that came from Spain after the Spanish Inquisition. They were scattered. They were forced out of Spain. Many of them lived in North Africa. As you mentioned, the Rambam, Maimonides, was one of them. And he traveled to Iraq and sat in Babylon. And that's where he spread a lot of the religion that we're practicing today, the Halacha, the Talmud. All of this was written by a Sephardi Jewish person that lived in the Middle East. The Mizrahi identity is it's more recent. There were always a Dota Mizrah, the people of the East, was the Jews that live anywhere from the Maghreb all the way to Yemen. They were called by other Jews as the Edota Mizrach, the people of the East. And the Mizrahi identity was more recent. And it was meant because a lot of Jews that lived in the Middle East and North Africa were not Sephardim. They did not speak Ladino, which is a language that Sephardi Jews speak. They did not follow Sephardic traditions to the fullest extent. They did follow Sephardic religious practices, and perhaps that's why they were lumped in together with the Sephardi Jews. But their identity is very unique, and their story is very unique in the sense that they were oppressed as dhimmis, as second-class minority communities in Arab and Muslim lands. They were forced out as communities, so it wasn't like the Ashkenazi Jews were forced out from Europe after the Holocaust brutally as individuals that survived. Mizrahi Jews had their families forced out as units, but they were all oppressed by the same oppressor, and they arrived to Israel in the same way. Most of them arrived to Israel, some made it to America and the UK. But the point is that the Mizrahi identity, and again, and everyone can identify as they want to, Mizrahi identity encapsulates much more than just a tradition of how you practice your Jewish religion, rather than who you are as a Jewish person that has roots in the East. So I speak, you know, Judeo-Iraqi Arabic because my grandmother spoke that. I still cook Tunisian food. We still celebrate Eid al-Banat, which is a Tunisian holiday, and we eat specific foods in different holidays because this is my tradition from my parents. So for me to be Mizrahi means that it's not just a religious aspect of my Jewish identity. It's more than that. I'm sorry for the at length answer, but I hope it makes sense.
No, it's very important. What are some of the common elements of a Mizrahi Jewish identity? Well, I know, for example, that we get real sloppy. We just assume that Ashkenazic Jewish identity is all the same. But a Jew from Berlin and a Jew from Budapest, a Jew from Ukraine, they had different historic experiences. What are some of the differences in historic experiences among Mizrahi Jews? But even more important, what are the common elements of that identity?
Right. I think you're raising an important point because, of course, Mizrahi Jews from different countries or different areas have distinctive traditions. But the similarities that bring them together, just like what brings together a Polish Jew and a Jew from Germany, in the sense that they speak the same language or have some practices that are similar, they have different history, but the similarities bring them together. That's how they can, you know, they know that when they see an Ashkenazi community somewhere, they find that this is something that they would be more related to than a Sephardi community. And I think that the similarities for Mizrahi Jews is definitely the language. So you have Judeo-Arabic in some sort from that was developed in those countries. The cuisine is very similar. There's, again, distinctive in some countries, but very similar, very Middle Eastern. I think also the story of being an indigenous religious minority in the Middle East, living under Arab Muslim rule, living with Muslims as neighbors. Some of them were good to them. Some of them were terrible to them. And the story of being oppressed is as this large community together for so long, then being expelled and losing everything they have without anyone in the world looking at them or recognizing them. To this day, it's even the book that I wrote, you know, I'm getting a lot of pushback from people that are saying that it's not necessary that I'm taking away from the story of the Holocaust or that I'm taking away from other Jewish stories by speaking about my community. And it's really sad that we're so far ahead in so many issues within our community. But this one issue, it seems like it's hard for us to deal with. And I find that even Mizrahi Jews find it difficult to connect to it. They don't want to speak about that. They were conditioned to think that they should just shut up about their identity and just say that they're Jewish, while their Ashkenazi brothers and sisters are speaking about being Ashkenazi so much. They're very proud of it. The culture, the Ashkenazi culture, the culture that we're seeing on TV and in movies when people are speaking about Jewish is usually Ashkenazi. And I think it's beautiful. I do love that we're seeing this Jewish culture in so many places. I'm just asking to share to expand the Jewish identity.
You mentioned the Shoah. Every American Jew can recite elements of European Jewish history. What are some of the key formative experiences in Mizrahi Jewish history, both the triumph and the trauma?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an important point. I think we have so much to be proud of from, we mentioned Maimonides, the Rambam, and we mentioned, we didn't mention it, but I mean, the stories of being in Babylon and dreaming about coming back to Zion. This is the Iraqi Jewish community, being part of the North African Jewish advancements and in Iran and in Yemen, being very, you know, a Jewish community that has contributed so much. I'm thinking about the relationship between the Iraqi Jews in Iraq and India and those trades of the Sassoon family, a very permanent Iraqi Jewish family that contributed so much to the development of Iraq and the trading between Iraq and India. And that's why we eat, you know, amba today. Amba is this Iraqi Jewish spread that is made from mangoes and some spices. And it's really delicious, a bit spicy. And it was made the way that it is because the story of Iraqi Jews that took their spices to India and brought the mangoes from there and made this spread that it's just a story of Jewish perseverance and success. And when we speak about the Holocaust, as you said, I can tell you of the name of every camp in Europe and the tragedy that happened to I feel like it's my people. I mean, it is my people. I feel like it's my story as well that happened to my people in Europe. My people also suffered in North Africa and they also suffered in Iraq by the long hand of the Nazis. Besides just living as a minority in the Arab world, we are reminded of the Farhud, those 2 days of violent attacks against the Jews of Iraq that happened in Shavuot 1941, when hundreds of Jews were killed, thousands were injured, property was stolen, stores were burnt. People they say that it's the Kristallnacht of Iraqi Jews. And in a way it is. It was the time that Iraqi Jews realized that they can't stay because everyone turned against them. And it all started because of Nazi agents incited it in Iraq. They came from Germany to Iraq and convinced the rulers there to start this attack on the Jews of Iraq. Very similar story happened to the Jews of Tunisia. My father, they were, you know, not only oppressed for so long, but also when the Vichy regime, the French regime, the French Nazi regime was controlling North Africa, they forced the Jews to work in forced labor camps. 5,000 Jews were sent to death camp in Europe. My grandfather was supposed to be sent to a death camp and the war was over just in time for him to survive. But it was supposed to, I mean, who knows if I would be here if they succeeded. The Holocaust happened to all Jews. The severe attack, I mean, I'm not comparing, and that's something that I'm being challenged on a lot. So it's important to make it clear. I'm not comparing what happened, the systemic genocide of 6 million Jews in Europe, to what happened in the Middle East. Of course, the violence was not as, I mean, people want me to put levels, and I hate to do that, but there wasn't death camps in the Middle East. But there was violence that happened because of the Shoah in Europe that spread to those lands as well.
On that sobering note, let's take a brief break. That was the Piyut Ensemble performing Ya'arat Dvash, the words of the Mizrahi Jewish poet Yisrael Najara. That is the musical and cultural heritage that we seek to reclaim. And I really have to insert here that piyut, sacred Jewish poetry from the Middle Ages, is a hot cultural thing in Israel. You can walk into a record store, they still have record stores, and you can ask the guy behind the desk, as I do all the time, can you point me to the piyut section? What do you have that's new in piyut? And this is, I think, in large measure, a contribution of Mizrahi Judaism. Once again, I am Rabbi Jeff Salkin. This is Martini Judaism, for those who want to be shaken and stirred, from the Religion News Service. And our guest is Chen Mazig, author of The Wrong Kind of Jew, A Mizrahi Manifesto. Chen, you have been shaking and stirring us. You know, sometimes we tell the story that whereas European Jewish life, life under the Christian yoke, often contained nightmares, that the story of Jews in Arab lands was comparatively better. What's the truth in that perception?
Well, it depends what you mean by better, right? When I speak to my grandmother, I remember before she shared the horror stories, she was always describing the life in Iraq as a beautiful one. They loved living there. They felt like they were part of the society and contributing to it. And the more I asked, the more I realized that they weren't really equal citizens, and that to be a dhimmi, what means in Arabic, and a protected minority, means that you are protected as long as the ruler wants you to be protected. When they don't no longer want you to be protected, you're going to be attacked. And that's what happened to them. And, you know, living in those countries meant that you are being a dhimmi, meant for Jews, that they weren't able to own houses that were taller than or higher than a house of a Muslim. They weren't allowed to ride horses. My great grandfather was a lawyer, but he wasn't allowed to be a lawyer because it was a Muslim court. So he got a different title, and he was working as a lawyer, but he couldn't be a fully lawyer because of the Islamic law. There were so many rules that really subjugated and oppressed the Jewish community and put them in their place, which was to be a second class citizen or worse. And while they were really, you know, they lived with their neighbors in a positive way, supported one another and learned from them and cooked together and had wonderful life for some part of it, they were still without rights and without autonomy and without anyone to protect them. And when those violent attacks happened throughout the Middle East, towards the creation of Israel, but way before that it started, no one was there to support them or protect them. And that was the reminder that they were foreign people in a foreign land. So I think you both can be true. On the one hand, that they were really living as a contributing part of society that was wonderful for them to live in this, you know, to be able to contribute so much. But then on the other hand, to live as an oppressed minority that was without rights. And when the countries that they lived in decided to kick them out, there was no one to stop that.
You're a fervent Zionist. You're a defender of Israel. In fact, that is how I first came to know you, in Twitter land. And I admire that. It's necessary more than ever. Can you talk a little bit more about the challenges of defending Israel in public space, in the cyber world in general?
Yeah, of course. I think that it's so hard to be openly Israeli and Zionist online today and offline in the West. I think that it's almost something that people are ashamed of. And there's nothing to be ashamed of. I think that Israel is a wonderful country in the Middle East. I think that the problem is that people are viewing Israel as another Western country or a utopia, a Western utopia, like another American state. And we know that it's not. Israel is a Middle Eastern country and it has its challenges. I was on a panel recently about the Israeli elections here in London. And they were, the people that were on the panel, British Jews, were all speaking about the elections, the results of the elections, as if it was the end of the world. The situation is so bad. It's the end of Israel. Israel will not exist as a Jewish and democratic state in the future. And I had to remind them that, you know, Boris Johnson, the prime minister here, made worse statements than some of the statements that they were referring to. And one of the speakers said, well, you know, the problem is that Ben-Gvir, one of the politicians that were recently elected, that had made racist and terrible statements, I agree. But he said that Ben-Gvir is talking about controlling more land and said, this is very not Jewish. We're in Judaism, we don't believe in controlling land, other people's land. And I said, you're right. Maybe it's not Jewish in your definition of Jewish, but it's very much Middle Eastern. And Ben-Gvir is the son of Kurdish Iraqi Jews. And that's where this is brought from. It's brought from the Middle East and it's in the Middle East. And I don't approve it, but I'm just saying that we need to understand that Israel is not a European country. It's not a Western country in the fullest extent. It is, I think we want it to be a democracy, and Israelis do want to live in a democratic state and be separated from the Palestinians in some way. That's what the polling is saying, most of them. But we need to look at Israel in the lens of another Middle Eastern country, because it is. And the fight for the legitimacy of Israel is very difficult. It's very difficult online, getting attacks and death threats on a daily basis. But I remind myself that what happened to my grandparents was far worse than the challenges that I'm going through. So that's what keeps me going. And I'm continuing to fight for our country and our people.
I'm going to really lean in on the whole issue of what's going on in Israel, because you mentioned that Ben-Gvir is a Kurdish Jew. There is a story that American Jews like to tell, that the right-wing turn of Israel into a more conservative country can largely be laid at the feet of the Mizrahim. And I've often wondered how much of this is internal Jewish bigotry. How do we fight this narrative?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at the Prime Minister Netanyahu, that has been the face of the right wing in Israel for over a decade, and he's not Mizrahi. I mean, the people that have been in the leadership of those right wing governments in Israel, or right wing parties, and well, governments as well. I mean, Naftali Bennett and others, are Ariel Sharon. You're reminded of every right wing politician in Israel that led a party until recently. They were Ashkenazi Jews, and I think that really is telling us that it's not based on where these people are coming from, rather than their political agenda. And in Israel, there's not really a difference between the left and the right on many issues. I mean, both the left and the right believe in healthcare that is subsidized by the government. They believed in free market. They believe in some aspect of social support to individuals. There's a lot of similarities. The one thing they differ on is the security element of the country. And I think that perhaps what people are alluding to is more that Mizrahi Jews have generational trauma. I often hear that, people saying, well, Mizrahi Jews are racist to Arabs. And I'm saying, how can they be racist to Arabs? We share the same culture. We lived in the same place. It's not racism. It's trauma and it's fear, and it's legitimate fear. My grandmother still is afraid. You know, when I published my book, she told me that whatever I do, I have to make sure that it doesn't get to Iraq, because they'll see my face and they'll see her and they'll come to us. And when she moved to Israel from Iraq, you know, they lived in Petah Tikva, and there were rockets coming from Iraq in 1991 to Israel, and they fell in Ramat Gan, where is the highest population of Iraqi Jews. So those Jews that left Iraq, came to Israel, thought they were safe, were getting rockets from Iraq. And then we had the Intifada and another Intifada. So all this violence was continuing to a reminder that that Mizrahi Jews, while they are safe, the Arab forces that have been prosecuting them for so long are still prosecuting them. So it's not racism per se. It's more of different experience and trauma that they're carrying with them for decades.
Let's talk about integration. What have been the challenges of Mizrahim in Israel, culturally, politically, interpersonally?
Right. Well, there has been so many challenges. We mentioned the politics. I don't think I need to expand on that, but definitely we haven't been represented as much as we should when we remember that Mizrahi Jews are over 50% of Israeli Jews today, to see numbers like, or that only 7% of Israeli academic faculty is Mizrahi, or that there was never a president of a university that was Mizrahi. There was one, I think, that was half or quarter Iraqi. But in all of the universities, you never had any president that was Mizrahi or identifying as Mizrahi. You never had any head of Olympic committee in Israel that was Mizrahi. You never had any head of theater in official national theater in Israel that was Mizrahi, or head of film foundation in Israel that are Mizrahi. So all of this really is not to say that we are that I think that Ashkenazim shouldn't be represented in those places. They should, but I think that as over 50% of this country Jewish community, to not have Mizrahim so underrepresented. Or we're looking also at the numbers of salaries and the difference, the gaps between first, second, third generation Mizrahi Jews and Ashkenazi Jews. And the gap is 30% more for an Ashkenazi Jew. And all this is to say that there's still a challenge, and that often I'm getting that from American Jews or Ashkenazi American Jews telling me, well, you know, we just care about education more, and and that's why we're more successful. And I'm looking at the French Moroccan Jewish community, which is the largest sect of the community in France today. And they have produced Nobel Prize winners. They produced billionaires and people that are so successful in their community. And they are the leading force of the Jewish community in France. So I don't think it's because Moroccan Jews are, or Ashkenazi Jews have, or any type of Jews have more affiliation towards or more respect to the academy. It's more about the opportunities that you have. And Mizrahi Jews still live in the periphery by and large. They still have limited access to resources. When they go to high school, the majors that they can choose from are not the same majors as you can choose from in Tel Aviv and Herzliya. In Tel Aviv and Herzliya, you have a variety of ideas. You can go to study technology right when you're in high school, and when you live in the periphery, you choose usually between car mechanics and household management, and that's really setting them and leading them towards a future that is not as equal as we haven't leveled the playing field yet, or the beginning for those kids. And this is what I think Israel need to work on changing, on improving the starting point for all kids, that it will all be the same, there won't be any preference. And it's not done by, it's not racial or you know, based on their identity, but it's more about where these communities are living. And because Mizrahim live in the peripheral towns of Israel, they have less access and less preference in these fields.
Two things. You're saying these words, and I'm thinking of the great French Jewish philosopher and public intellectual, Bernard-Henri Lévy, who, as I recall, is either Algerian or Tunisian.
Yeah, I think it's Algerian.
Right. A people that produces Bernard-Henri Lévy need not apologize for anything, not to mention Rambam himself. One of the things that struck me when I read your book that I never thought about, and it really shook me, was about the experience of Mizrahi Jews, not in Israel, but in the United States. What is the situation in terms of American Jewish communal life? Where are you?
The funny thing is, I thought that I wasn't special in this sense, that I remember getting to America the first time and being stopped by the immigration officer and over again facing it. And I thought maybe all Israelis are facing it. But then I realized that my Ashkenazi friends could pass more easily, and that maybe something about me was, maybe it's the beard or the name. And then I remember going to synagogues and being, that was the first time that ever in my life, I mean, I grew up in Israel, never I was questioned about my identity, but getting to a synagogue and having the police officer asking me, what am I doing there? And I'm saying, well, I'm coming here to speak to the community. And he's like challenging me and not believing that I'm really Jewish. Again, I don't know why. And I kept thinking about it. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that it's might be just the fact that I don't look like the rest of the congregation, and I don't speak the same way. And also in Jewish organizations, you know, most of the leadership of Jewish organizations is Ashkenazi. Mizrahi Jews are not really represented anywhere, I would say, generally in the Jewish activism world. When people speak, even now I just see this attack on this one individual. I'm not even going to go into this whole Twitter social media drama, but like a Jewish man that is Mizrahi that said something that a lot of voices didn't like, and they started attacking him. And I just you can't ignore the fact that he's Mizrahi and that they are attacking him for saying, he said in an interview that he's not Ashkenazi, although he's half Ashkenazi. And Twitter was very upset about it. And listen, I disagree. Being Jewish and disagreeing with other people is totally fine. But I continuously find this ideas that are spread about how Mizrahi Jews should just like stop speaking about their identity and we just need to fall in line. But it's totally fine for Ashkenazi Jews to speak about their identity. I saw someone tweeting that we need to, this Ashkenazi kid saying, we need to stop focusing on aesthetic of the Jewish community, which we know it's a euphemism to saying how those Jewish people look like. And all of this is just, it's just really heartbreaking because we are one people. I'm the one that has been saying it for so long that we're one people, that we need unity, that we need to come together. And that's all I want. That's all that Mizrahim want. We want to be together. We want to be as one and we want to be part of the Jewish community. That's what we're asking for. But it's just, you know, it's really heartbreaking and very troubling to see that other Jews do not want us to speak and that when we speak, it's divisive. Although we know that the people that are speaking about coming together are not the divisive ones, but it's the people that are telling them not to speak about it that are trying to divide us. And I think the more we are celebrating, and that's the point of the book, really. It was about celebrating identity and being proud of your identity and remembering that if we are going to shun those young Jewish voices that are diverse, that want to speak about their diversity, if the Jewish community will exclude them, they're going to go to other community. And then there will be minority Jews within other communities. There will be minority Jews within, I see that, with an Arab Jews, as they define themselves, which I reject completely. But I think that's a result of the Jewish community rejecting those voices. And then they have to find other communities to accept them. And I don't want it to happen. So I think that was the goal of me writing this book in the way that I did.
You said something devastating to me. I just want to check this out. Is it in fact the case that there are no American Jewish organizations that are led professionally or in a lay sense by Mizrahi Jews?
I really can't think of one. I think that the LA Jewish Federation now is led by a Mizrahi Jew. There's a few, but it's still such a minority. Even the Sephardic Jewish Federation is led by an Ashkenazi, which, you know, I raised that once and I said, like, what do you think about that? And I got attacked for it, for saying it. But I just think that, you know, Sephardi Jews would be better. It's the difference between seeing us as an artifacts in museum that you just look at and seeing us as real living people that are wanting to continue our story and live it. And I feel like that's, I just wish more Jewish organizations would have embraced that and embraced its diversity. It just does good for our community and for our people.
Do we put Iranian Jews into this bulging file folder as well?
Yeah, I think that Iranian Jews, based on many conversations I had with Iranian Jews, they feel like they are part of this community. I think that they are part of this community as well because of, again, the fact that they speak Farsi, Judeo-Farsi, and they have the very similar customs and very similar oppression by the same similar oppressor and how they left this country. And I'm putting them together with us because I think it will also help us achieve better representation. Persian Jews are still underrepresented. And the reason that all those communities are always off, I often hear that when people say, well, Syrian Jews are so closed off, Persian Jews are so closed off. And I'm asking, yeah, I'm saying, yeah, right. Those communities in the US, in New York and in LA, they might be closed off. But if we tried asking ourselves, why do they feel like they have to be closed off? Have you invited them? Have you tried ever to be part? I mean, and I feel like the Jewish community at large has been just accepting that this is the reality. And it shouldn't be the reality. And I think that the fact that it's like that is because they've been shunned for so long and they had to take care of each other because no one else was taking care of them. And their own people were rejecting them. So I think that's where it comes from. So I'm trying to include as many people as possible. In my eyes, as I said, I think all Jews were once Mizrahim. We all share this identity and I wish we all could go back to it.
Which brings me to the final question. First of all, I think that what I said at the very beginning holds true, which is that there is a piece of Mizrahi Jewish identity that is a little looser, a little less obsessed with halakha, with Jewish law, than Ashkenazic Judaism is. I've seen this in real life. Years ago, I was having lunch on Shabbat, I now confess this, at a non-kosher restaurant in Great Neck, New York, seeing an entire table of Iranian Jews next to me wearing kippot that had just come from synagogue. And I'm saying to myself, what's up with that? And I realized that they found the affirmative act of eating together on Shabbat more important than their prohibition of spending money on Shabbat and eating in a treif restaurant. I think there's something to be learned from this, but there's something I want to just finish up with. The part of your book that I loved the most, because I'm very much into thinking about what does it mean for Jews to be a tribe? I'd like us to be a tribe without being tribalistic. That's another conversation. But you write that Jews are an indigenous people. Tell us more about that. And I'm wondering what kind of opportunities does that definition, that metaphor present to us as Jews?
That's an excellent point, because that really was the important part of my book, to talk about the indigenous connection. Every people started somewhere, and where you started as a people, that's where you're indigenous to. That's the definition. And I feel like Judaism has been so changed, and even for us, the way that we're looking at it today as Jews, we're looking at it as a religion that is much like Christianity. And it's not. Being Jewish, we know that it's an ethnicity, that it's culture, that it's history, but it's also the indigenous connection. The religious aspect of Judaism is just manifesting our indigenous connection. You know, we're speaking about Shema Yisrael. Shema Yisrael, the most important prayer in Judaism, is about how to work the land in Israel when you are in Israel. We have Sukkot, where we wave four species of vegetables to six directions of the wind. This is indigenous practice. That's what indigenous people do. Or Native Americans, if you go to them on Friday, they invite spirits to their homes. They're inviting the spirits to sit with them, to pray, to bless them, and then leave, which the same thing that we do with the angels of peace. And it's so many elements of Judaism are all about, you know, Judaism is an agricultural, agrarian religion. It's about the land. And as long as we maintain the connection to the land, land of Israel, as long as we pray towards Jerusalem, we're not just praying towards Jerusalem because of the temple, where the temple was standing. We're praying towards Jerusalem because this is our land. And this is what indigeneity is. And indigeneity, as long as you maintain this connection, you are indigenous to this land. And it's okay to live in other places, in other imperial forces, as long as you're remembering where we come from and where we started. And I think that's really the key to understanding Judaism, to explaining Judaism, is to talk about this, our indigenous connection to the land of Israel, because it's definitely where we started. It's definitely where we are now maintaining our Jewish identity and how Jewish identity is flourishing. And that's going to be the one thing that will save us as Jewish people, always will be there to save us. Yeah, so I think it's really important that we recognize that and remember where our people started and where we wish one day return to.
I'm going to take you back to 1976. This was my year in Israel when I was starting my studies for the rabbinate at Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion. They took us to a kibbutz outside of Jerusalem for a Shabbat. And the entire purpose of this, and this is a foundational memory in my rabbinical training, was to meet members of the Black Panthers. Now, these were not the American Black Panthers. It wasn't as if they had brought in Eldridge Cleaver or Bobby Seale, though many of us would not have protested that opportunity. In fact, we were meeting with members of the Israeli Black Panthers. They had modeled themselves and their activism on the American Black Panthers. These were Mizrahi Jews, and they were there to tell us about the social gap in Israel. I'll never forget this. Neither will I ever forget the term that they taught us. They had a term that they used to describe the forces that they were up against. The term was WASP. Now, I'm familiar with the term WASP. In American ethnic culture, that means white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. This was a different kind of WASP. For them, the WASP was white Ashkenazic Sabras with protectia. Now, let me unpack this for you. White Ashkenazic, which means someone whose parents or grandparents came from Central Europe or Eastern Europe, like most American Jews, which is to say, like many of the founders of the Jewish state. A Sabra is someone who was born in Israel, and that designation had greater social cachet than being an immigrant. Now, protectia is a good one. It comes from the word protection. It means someone who has social juice. influence, the ability to make things happen. It means elite connections. In those days, you needed protekcija in order to get a phone. That defined the Israeli elite at that time. On the day that our program ended, July 1977, that was the day that Menachem Begin, who was as Ashkenazic as it gets, was elected Prime Minister of Israel. And what was the source of his strength? He pledged to pay attention to Sephardim and Mizrahim, and that began a social revolution in Israel that continues to this day. The Mizrahim constitute a majority of Israel's Jews. Between 3 and 4 million people and their unique culture and history have had a significant impact on what it means to be Israeli, who Israel's leaders are, and how the country's culture looks. Hand writes the following: "We are the blind spot in every narrative about our country, including those stories that Israelis have been telling themselves. For decades, we were dismissed by the Ashkenazic elites as a primitive variation of the Arabs, who have always been the country's big other. We need a Jewish world in which no one is other. We are a small people, but we are a very large family." This has been Rabbi Jeff Salkin of Temple Israel in West Palm Beach, Florida, and this has been Martini Judaism. For those who want to be shaken and stirred, the podcast, once again, I invite you to read my regular column on religionnews.com, and we are grateful to our friend Hen Mazig, author of The Wrong Kind of Jew, for being with us as our guest. So thank you, Hen. And I invite you all to read his book, The Wrong Kind of Jew, A Mizrahi Manifesto. Our producer is Jay Woodward. We get production assistance from Lance Roger Axt. Elsie Owen keeps our engines running smoothly. Martini Judaism is a Blue Jay Atlantic production for Religion News Service. Shalom, everyone. We'll see you again soon. Take care. Bye-bye.